From UFOs to ghosts and government cover-ups, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
And ladies and gentlemen, you know what that music means. Welcome to the show. I'm Ben.
And I'm Noel, the Necro Goat Slaughterer Brown.
Oh, that is good. We should do some black metal nicknames. You know, I feel like I'm hogging the nickname giving duties so often. Do you have a black metal nickname for me, Noel?
Man, it was everything I could do to come up with that one.
That was a good one.
It was kind of redundant. It's a Necro Goat.
Uh-huh.
Slaughterer. So yeah. Is it itself, does it only slaughter necro goats, or is it a necro goat that slaughters?
Right, yeah.
It's not clear. But you know what? Right. A little ambiguity in black metal is probably just fine. Ben, I'm going to call you. I'm going to take a cue from the Swedish black metal band Hellhammer, and I'm going to call you Ben Satanic Slaughter Bolin.
You know, I'll deal with that. I like the nested alliteration. Hellhammer was a member of a band, right?
A member of a band, but also a Swedish black metal band that was maybe active. No, they were active in the early 80s, and we'll get to that part of the story very soon as a way of segueing into what today's topic is, which is music and the occult.
That's right. And ladies and gentlemen, we're here. Most importantly, you're here. It's what we call the most wonderful time of the year over at Conspiracy Stuff. That is the countdown to Halloween. We are in the month of October. And stay tuned for the end because we have a little bit of administrative business to cover. But first, we're going to delve into something that a lot of people have asked us about. Noel, this was an idea that you came to us with, right?
Yeah, I mean, I just think there's a lot there to unpack, and there's a lot of opportunity, you know, to dig into some pretty interesting stuff when it comes to music and the occult, not only with things like black metal and Satanism, but just numerology and Illuminati symbology embedded in different works and, you know, popular culture references throughout the history of rock music, you know, so...
Yes, and it goes past rock music, which is something we're going to discover. So here, let's just paint the background a little bit, right? First things first, the music industry is, surprise, a huge business, gargantuan. Global recorded music sales totaled $15 billion in 2014. And that's even with, you know, the fall of paid media and more people just finding songs they'd rather listen to for free on a streaming service, right?
For sure.
Either way you cut it, it's a Leviathan business-wise. And that's because music is one of the few things that unites all human beings regardless of background. One of my favorite writers, Vladimir Nabokov, is one of the only people I ever heard of who just categorically didn't like music. He had synesthesia and he didn't get music. He said it was just this collection of noises to him. So other than one author who passed away a long time ago, pretty much everybody digs some sort of music. It occupies a unique niche in the human experience, and it appears, fun fact, to predate the written word, making the practice of music literally older than recorded history. So today we're going to talk about music, but you know what sort of show this is, folks. And you know our favorite holiday is coming up, so we're not just going to talk about the music industry or a few instances of conspiracy. No. And when we explore the entire concept of the relationship between music and the occult, there's one place we always have to start, right?
Absolutely. And that is with the devil, Satan, Lucifer. Old Scratch. I like that one.
Yeah, that's Old Scratch. One. How about The Devil Went Down to Georgia? Do you remember that song?
Of course, yeah.
Devil went down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul of steel.
Yeah. And I know he played a golden fiddle, and he gets into a fiddle off with Johnny? Is it Johnny?
Johnny.
The protagonist
Johnny
of the
and the devil.
Johnny
yeah.
rising up your wall and play a fiddle hard.
Lucas and Georgia and the devil deals in cards.
Yeah. yeah. And if you win, you get this shiny fiddle made of gold. But if you lose, the devil gets your soul. Definitely yeah. a callback to one of the early rock myths with Satan, which is the Robert Johnson story. You want to talk about that a little
yeah,
bit?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about this. This is something that you and I were talking about off air because you found a fantastic source for some of this, right?
I did. It's a book called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll by a guy named Peter Berbigol. Mm-hmm. Pronounce it like that. And it basically just is like kind of an oral history of as far back as like the blues and Elvis and things like that, about how just the connections between this idea of like selling your soul to the devil at the crossroads, you know, in order to gain the ability to write amazing songs and perform amazing music. And you know, back to the whole devil went down to Georgia theme, that is definitely where this comes from, which is the story of Robert Johnson, who was a very, very well-regarded blues singer and guitarist,
right.
largely credited for inventing many of the sounds and, you know, constructs that went on to be very important for much of popular music, especially,
sure.
you know, things like rock music.
Right. Yeah. And had relatively few recorded songs, but he did also have a song about going to the crossroads. He actually has a song about it, but this is also tropes or themes or versions of another story, you know, that one would go to the crossroads or through certain arcane preparations, strike a deal with dark powers.
Sure, it's like that Faust story, the Faustian
exactly.
bargain, you know, as they say. Mm-hmm. You know, you're basically exchanging your humanity for some boon that the devil, you know, which ultimately serves as a stand-in for any number of other malevolent dark forces.
Sure.
From
yeah.
whether it's voodoo culture or paganism or anything like that. It's certainly a part of a trope in all of those, you know, mythologies, I guess you could call them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We've talked about this on the show before, the idea of religious syncretism, that one religion or another will attempt to meld together to win over the people. So the idea that you mentioned there is brilliant, Noel. The Satan, the Abrahamic Satan, is a stand-in often for older gods or spirits in these stories. Trafficking with supernatural creatures for material gain is a very old idea. And, you know, we often see that. We talked about that in our other video, Five Things You Didn't Know About Satan. Listeners, of course, if you're checking out this show right now, then you already know that the trident and the goat legs are examples of this kind of religious syncretism, trying to vilify pre-existing gods. But here's an interesting thing. In Abrahamic tradition, Lucifer was known as the angel of music before he fell from God's grace, or that's what you'll hear a lot of people say. And so this devil, this Promethean figure, has been associated with music and musicians in a number of ways. There's another case of someone who was alleged to sell their soul to the devil, and that was Niccolo Paganini. This guy, a violinist, right?
By all accounts, just the best there ever was at the time. You know, just incredibly fast, incredibly proficient, just insane technique. I actually grew up playing violin, so was aware of him and kind of the shadow that he cast on the history of performing. So it makes sense that he would have gotten cast as one of these figures that made some sort of Faustian bargain in order to get those mad violin skills.
So yeah, he sold his soul. He made a pact with the devil. And for those of you who are interested, I will say, I guess I wouldn't recommend trying some kind of nefarious magic. But if you're looking for a way to do it, you can find things like the Lesser Key of Solomon. That's a grimoire, or the Malus Maleficarum, which talks about some anecdotal ideas of pacts with Satan. So it gets pretty complex pretty quickly because, you know, calling the big one up is not necessarily recommended. You get, there are other lesser people you could work with, you know?
Sure.
So apparently there is a specific month or day of the week or hour to call these other demons and invoke some sort of pact. So it's buyer's market. If you want to sell your soul, I'm sure you are just several fascinating Google searches away from getting on the trail. But because of, I think because of this pre-linguistic mystical nature of music in the human experience, that it makes sense for us to see it associated with this idea of a magical thing.
Well, I mean, it actually brought to mind something that you said to me yesterday. We were hanging out off air. A friend of yours, you said, who was into practicing magic, had a really interesting way of describing what magic was. I think he used the phrase weaponized psychology. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I feel like music has some of that to it as well, because it's this whole package that combines something like a melody, which can invoke, certain responses emotionally just by nature of what the melody sounds like, with a lyrical content which can invoke many different things, whether it be nostalgia, whether it be some sort of longing or some kind of, you know, emotional response. And to me, that is a form of, you know, if you look at it this way, weaponized psychology, where you are eliciting a certain response from someone by combining these elements. And it is this sort of ritualistic thing, whether it's putting on a record or going to a concert, you know, you are participating in this invocation, let's say.
Yeah, there is a certain strange thing to it, right? I'm like, why do minor chords make people feel sad? Mm-hmm. Yes. And with that in mind, we're going to go to the next part of our show. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to discuss some conspiracies, both theories and facts, surrounding music and the occult. In other words, here's where it gets crazy.
One of the first connections here we'd like to discuss is the connection between metal, like heavy metal, and Satan. Back as you know, Black Sabbath, for example, you know, just the name Black Sabbath carries this weight of demonic, you know, worship of some kind. It's the idea of taking a holy day and making it, you know, shrouding it in darkness of some kind, you know?
Which is weird, because didn't Black Sabbath begin as a blues band?
I'm not 100% sure. It would make sense. They definitely have some blues qualities in their music as far as the riffs. And again, you know, a lot of metal is based in this idea of guitar riffs and playing these little motifs that kind of repeat. And obviously you can get into different genres that take that in various different directions. But at its heart, metal is a guitar-driven, you know, genre of music. So one of the most infamous genres of metal that has come out of that scene is something called black metal. Black metal. And I remember first hearing about black metal when I was much younger. I had a subscription to Spin magazine, and there was an issue that had all of these different figures from Norwegian black metal in this profile or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember their names, but they were all fantastic. Well, I'll give you just some examples.
All the names like Emperor.
Exactly. The names of the bands, sure, like Emperor, but the individuals.
Almighty. Oh, yeah.
The individuals who are in the bands all have this is from a band we were talking about earlier, the band Hellhammer, which again, not the same Hellhammer as one of the characters we're about to discuss in this story, but names like Satanic Slaughter, which is the nickname I gave Ben.
Thank you.
Slade Necros. These are members of the band. Satanic Slaughter was the guitarist and lead vocalist. Slade Necros, bass and backing vocals. Denial Fiend on drums. Savage Damage on bass and vocals. Evoked Damnator on bass. Mm-hmm. Grim Decapitator on bass. And these are all previous members. And Del Infernale on guitar.
Do you think any of them are listening to the show?
I hope not.
You don't want them to?
I'd be scared.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway, my point is, though, when I saw this profile in Spin, I remember there was one guy who talked about carrying around a decapitated raven's head in a satchel that he would sniff, you know, like before he went on stage to like, get the sense of death in his nostrils. And, you know, anyway, so I'm getting ahead of myself, but that was my first exposure to this black metal. And I think, you know, there's definitely different camps, but the main ones that we think about are the ones from Norway and the ones from Sweden.
Right. So the interesting thing here is that so much of entertainment is just
showmanship.
That. Yeah, showmanship, exactly. So we're all familiar perhaps with different organizations that will put on a spectacle, but then go home, have a nice cup of Earl Grey, and then, I don't know, ask the kids about their day before going to sleep at 11:35 sharp. So there's an important distinction to make between what is smoke and mirror and what is actually happening. I despise, and we're going to talk about this in a little more detail in a second, but I despise the laziness or the lack of critical thinking when people paint with such a broad brush and say, all black metal, all people involved in black metal are these lunatic cannibal necro goat slaughterers, right? To use your nickname, because it's simply not true. But there is something we can talk about, which was seen as an occult link by many opponents, and that is the prevalence of church burnings. In the Norwegian black metal scene alone, there were over 50 arsons of Christian churches from 92 to 96. So what this shows us is that it was at least in vogue for people who believed that members of the black metal scene in Norway were practicing Satanists or something. This was considered the smoking gun, or not to be crass, but the smoking church.
Sure.
And the problem with that is that people who are doing that or people who were not opposed to it would say, this is not about Satanism. This is about the opposition of Christian religion.
Absolutely. Right?
Still, you're burning buildings.
Yeah, this sort of comes back to this idea that we were beginning to touch on of appearance versus action. So, for example, like Ozzy Osbourne, yeah, sure, he may have snorted a line of ants in the heyday of his drug haze, but it certainly wasn't in tribute to the Dark Lord, you know. And, I mean, maybe they dabbled, you know, Black Sabbath dabbled in some ideas of occult teachings, but they certainly are not thought to have been a satanic band, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, or like another example is, like Alice Cooper, you know, a lot of costumes, a lot of set pieces,
right.
You know, a lot of kind of horror, grand guignol kind of showmanship.
And you could say the same about even Kiss, for instance.
Kiss, yeah, to a much lesser degree. I mean,
right.
Kiss to me has always just been absurd, and there's not really anything scary about what they're doing. But Alice Cooper or even a Marilyn Manson, you know, and I mean, Manson did it, profess to be a follower of Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan and things like that. But I think a lot of that was just sort of like a way to rebel against some of what we're talking about, like these Judeo-Christian kind of beliefs.
Sure, and Anton LaVey, or the philosophy of the Church of Satan, is not necessarily the deistic Satanism that people might think of if they are.
It's a symbol,
Christian.
More or less, of rebellion and of what is it, do what thou wilt, you know, kind of like just basically don't follow anyone's rules but your own. It's a very kind of hedonistic, ultimately kind of a selfish way of life.
Which they would say is not really problematic. I would say it's ironic, though, if you're reading, like any religion that says, do what you want, and here are the rules for how you do what you want. Cause is that what you want to do? There's just a cognitive dissonance. But anyhow, I'm not knocking the Church of Satan. I am pointing out that a lot of people probably misinterpret its philosophy. But while we're here, Noel, with Marilyn Manson, let's follow this. Let's go a little bit down the rabbit hole, because the group, which I guess began as Marilyn Manson and the Spooky Kids.
Sure.
Had the idea of taking the name of a famous beauty queen or actress, right?
Some sort of Hollywood icon, you know.
Right. and combining it with the surname of a serial killer.
Right.
So we have things like what we have Marilyn Manson, Twiggy Ramirez.
Yeah, Twiggy Ramirez. There was Gidget Gain, which was Ed Gain, the surname, and Gidget. As far as I can tell, is a reference to a film from 1959 from Columbia Pictures, starring Sandra Dee, Cliff Robertson, and James Darren. Sort of like a, you know, it looks like a very quintessentially Hollywood type film from the time.
Right, and then there's Daisy Berkowitz.
Mm-hmm.
These names, you see the pattern, but let's focus on Marilyn Manson's name in specific, because that's Marilyn Monroe and Charles Manson.
Mm-hmm.
So, Charles Manson is himself, Manson, the Manson family, are at the crux of several other interconnecting theories, right? And he was in the musical underground of California for a while, too.
I think he was way underground. He was a very charismatic dude and was able to kind of curry favor and like kind of become friends and get into the inside circle with some relatively famous musicians. Like, for example, like he kind of knew, forget which Beach Boy he spent time with, but it was definitely one of them. And he was trying to kind of, you know, cheat his way into the music industry, more or less. He was not a particularly talented songwriter. I actually, at one point years ago, had a copy of just a compilation of all of his songs, and they're very bad. It's not. There's nothing particularly engaging or commercial. There's nothing particularly sellable about any of this music, and it's borderline unlistenable. Unless you are able to just do it kind of as an artifact of here's what Charles Manson sounds like playing acoustic guitar.
As like a historical oddity
exactly.
of some sort.
Yeah.
But so, okay, this, you know, it's interesting that you say that because let's explore some of the other aspects of Manson's rise and fall. While he was incarcerated, as he was for most of his life, I think technically now the majority of his life he's been locked away one place or another. He was exposed to some of the principles and techniques of something called Dianetics, which would become later Scientology, as a precursor for that. He also had his own brand of cult creation, and we studied him fairly extensively when we were looking at Matt and I did a video about how cults work. And how, you know, how one erases the ego, removes the ability to think critically or proactively, you know, and turns people really into limbs of a larger body rather than their own person. And one thing that's strange about this is that this ties into what are often considered occult techniques. And the word occult, just to be clear, is often treated with a magical context here in the States and in our modern day. But, it also, the base of it really means hidden, you know? So I would say that the techniques Manson was thought of using, right? Or people who believe that he was exercising something like mesmerism or hypnosis, which he was, that would be seen as a hidden skill, an occult approach. And it worked. He had people brainwashed, had them out in the desert, convinced that there was going to be a race war that would take over the entire world. They were going to live in a secret cave.
Yeah. Helter Skelter.
Yes, sir. Helter Skelter. Culminating, of course, in some murders.
Yeah, and this, you know, I know we're kind of jumping all over the place with this, but this is just, it's fascinating, and it's easy to, there's a lot of rabbit holes to go down. So you'll have to forgive us if we go a little bit out of order on some of this stuff. There was a series of murders that the Manson family perpetrated, and there's another connection with some of these, back to some of the other things we're talking about. The first set was, the Sharon Tate house. It was, Roman Polanski, the director who did Rosemary's Baby. He did Chinatown, it's one of my favorites, and more recently, he did like The Pianist and The Ninth Gate with Johnny Depp, and he continues to work. Very controversial figure in his own right, but that's for another day. So the Manson and his followers, who I believe were mostly women.
Yes.
They broke into this house and they murdered Tate and her entourage, I guess. She was having a party or had some friends over at the time. Polanski was not there. He was out of town. It's actually a really excellent, just sort of a side topic, a book by an author named Jerzy Kaczynski. Called Blind Date. And Jerzy Kaczynski wrote, the book Being There, which is was made into a fantastic film starring Peter Sellers. But in Blind Date, he actually was friends with Roman Polanski and was supposed to be at this house when these murders happened. And he writes sort of a fictionalized account of how he, managed to not be there and what ended up happening and sort of the aftermath of it. But he doesn't really write it like as a first person, like from his own perspective. So it's very interesting. If you want to learn more about it, that's a good place to start. So the next night, Manson felt like they had not done the best job at the Tate house, so they wanted to give it another go, I guess. So they went to the home of a supermarket executive named Lino LaBianca, where he and his wife Rosemary, who owned a dress shop, lives. It was in the Los Feliz neighborhood of Los Angeles. And it was during this kind of killing spree that Manson and his followers would cover the walls in different phrases that later became iconic, like Helter Skelter and Death to the Pigs, and this idea of him trying to start a race war, Rise. And Helter Skelter is obviously a reference to the Beatles song Helter Skelter off the White Album.
Right. And there's another connection. Two interesting side notes before we go on. There are more suspected murders on part of Manson and the Manson family out there in the desert. And people aren't sure who else got caught, who was killed in Los Angeles and just not associated with it. Helter Skelter could have been much worse. In fact, one of the reasons it wasn't is because a guy who doesn't get enough credit in the story, a fellow named Paul Crockett, a retired prospector who had also studied, oddly enough, Scientology, and apparently began to deprogram some of the people. Some of the people in the Manson family. Paul Crockett's story is mysterious to me. I invite you listeners to look it up and let me know what you think. We covered it briefly in one of our earlier videos, but there's a lot more to that story that remains untold. And, you know, I feel like we might be getting closer to falling into a Charles Manson podcast. You know,
I know it's some really interesting stuff there for sure. A little side note and kind of bringing it back to the music thing, we definitely went down a little bit of a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
The LaBianca mansion, actually the Tate mansion was demolished. I'm not quite sure how long ago, but it's been some years. The LaBianca mansion still stands and has had some renovations done, but, Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails actually rented that mansion in order to make their iconic record, The Downward Spiral. And he was fascinated by, you know, the Manson mythology and all of that as well. And so, I mean, it just kind of comes back to this connection with music and the occult and, you know, true believers versus, you know, showmen. And, you know, I think there is some shock value in being sort of like a fringe, like sort of a dark musician, a dark artist, kind of like like Nine Inch Nails kind of has like a sort of a sinister, kind of a creepy vibe to it. Mm-hmm. And like saying we made our record in the house where the Manson murders happened.
And you know what this reminds me of, Noel, is a story that inspired a part of this podcast, which you had told me originally off air, and I had no idea about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons that I wanted to explore this Manson connection, what this made me think of is this story about one of my favorite artists, musicians of all times, David Bowie. And in the mid-70s, Bowie was deep in his Thin White Duke phase. And anyone who knows about Bowie would recognize the look of David Bowie during this period easily. Super thin, very pale. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that he was just off the rails on cocaine at the time. But during this period, he actually lived in a mansion that was just down the road from the La Bianca house, which is where that second set, arguably the more grisly set of Manson murders took place. And during this period, and a lot of this is from the book that I mentioned earlier, which is called, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. Definitely worth checking out. You can get it as an ebook on Amazon. During this period, he had just completely lost himself to this cocaine addiction. And I mean, you're David Bowie. He was just obscenely famous at this point. You know, he could get whatever he wanted. He had this mansion. He was probably not leaving very often, just getting piles of cocaine delivered to him. And he started worrying about, things like the, like Nazi conspiracies, the Manson murders, you know, his own bodily essences and bodily fluids and what that meant, you know, like sort of like, that character in, Dr. Strangelove, who's always talking about his precious bodily fluids.
Right. You know?
Definitely a lot of paranoia going on there. And he became convinced that because of the proximity to the La Bianca house, there were malevolent spirits that were invading his world, whether it was his home, his psyche, you know, all over the place. So he decided to seek the help of what we would refer to as a white witch.
A follower of the right-hand path.
Exactly. So the house that Bowie was renting belonged to a guy named Glenn Hughes, who was the bassist for the band Deep Purple, Smoke on the Water, and things like that. And this is a quote from a guy named Mark Spitz, who wrote a Bowie biography. I don't know if it was particularly sanctioned, but it definitely exists. He was around during these days. And the author of Season of the Witch did use him as a source on several occasions. So here's a quote from him describing what Hughes thought about David Bowie's situation.
Fine.
Quote, he felt inclined to go on very bizarre tangents about Aleister Crowley or the Nazis or numerals a lot. He was completely wired, maniacally wired. I could not keep up with him. He was on the edge all the time of paranoia and also going on about things I had no friggin' idea of what he was talking about. He'd go into a rap on it and I wouldn't know what he was talking about. And then as Bowie himself remembered in this book, my other fascination was with the Nazis and their search for the Holy Grail. I paid with the worst manic depression of my life. My psyche went through the roof. It just fractured into pieces. I was hallucinating 24 hours a day. I felt like I'd fallen into the bowels of the earth. So it was during this period for David Bowie that he reached out to someone named Cherry Vanilla, who was one of a former employee of Bowie's management company, who had been around and witnessed much of his debauchery and paranoia. And she was the one who put him in touch with this white witch named Wally Elmlark. And the idea was that Elmlark would come into this mansion in Los Feliz and exorcise the place, whether it was, you know, saging it and just kind of like performing some rituals to clear it of evil spirits.
And saging it would be when you burn sage around different areas of a place, right?
Exactly.
So, Noel, I have to ask something that's probably on the mind of at least a few listeners here. Do you think there were evil spirits on the premises?
Well, to quote Dave Chappelle doing Rick James, cocaine's a hell of a drug.
That's what I – to quote Rick James doing Rick James.
Yeah.
Cocaine's a hell of a drug, apparently.
Yeah, and I mean, it does sound like Bowie was just out of his mind with paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you get that way and you feel like you can't trust anybody, you see devils at every turn, you know? You know, there is an account, just to wrap this little story up, which I think is fun. I mean, definitely the guy was in a very, very dark place. He was in a very dark place. And for someone to be able to offer him some sort of help, whether it was BS or not, can't really fault him too much.
He's okay now.
No, he's definitely okay. Shockingly okay. Look at the guy. He looks like he's 20 years old. It's bizarre. So, you know, this Wally Elmlark character did end up coming into the house and she, you know, apparently, according to those present, successfully exorcised the swimming pool. That was the first thing she wanted to do, that he wanted to do, was exercise the swimming pool. And this is a quote from Backstage Passes, Life on the Wild Side with David Bowie, which is a memoir by Angie Bowie, who was David's wife during this period. And she says, quote, "At a certain point in the ritual, the pool began to bubble. It bubbled vigorously, perhaps thrashed is a better term, in a manner inconsistent with any explanation involving filters and the like." And then Mark Spitz, from earlier from this unauthorized Bowie memoir, I guess, wrote, quote, "Elmlark wrote a series of spells and incantations out for Bowie in case the demons returned for a dip, and remained on call for Bowie as he continued to wrestle with the forces of darkness."
Wow. I'm going to say cocaine.
Yeah.
If I had to, I had to choose one, not to be too skeptical about it. But we see, okay, so we see this edge of madness intersecting with some of the appearance of madness, which is good for marketing, right?
Sure.
Versus just the strange situations you get into when you catapult to this unprecedented level of fame and success. But madness aside, let's take a closer look at the people who, regardless of drug use or anything like that, sincerely believe that they are part of an occult movement or part of a magical working. We know that allegations of some sort of demonic worship are pretty old. You know, they predate Bowie, of course.
Of course.
In popular music and rock music especially. For instance, the Rolling Stones have been accused of this. And
or even like Led Zeppelin, the idea of backwards masking and messages hidden that were like embedded in the inner ring of an LP, for example, things like that.
Right, exactly. And this, you know, this goes into something interesting that we can explore, the idea of the moral panic, right? The satanic panic.
Sure.
But before we do that, there are a couple other things we should talk about. There is evidence, as we've said, of real occult conspiracies in music. One of the biggest ones, of course, being that members of the black metal scene in some Scandinavian countries did conspire to burn churches.
Right.
Now, as for the motivation of that, it probably isn't the same motivation behind every single church burning, because there are different groups doing it.
Right, and we mentioned this earlier, the idea that it was, in large part, an act of rebellion against, you know, the idea of sort of what they might perceive as an oppressive, puritanical, not government exactly, but just sort of like hierarchy, I guess, a dogma, exactly.
Yeah.
So there's certainly that aspect of it, but there's also this idea of being like, it's almost like a gang mentality where you have to do these initiations in order to show that you're completely behind what the gang is about. Mm-hmm. It's very similar with some of these black metal groups where they're, you know, burning the churches to show their commitment, to demonstrate their commitment to these ideals. And why don't you talk a little bit about what some of those ideals might be and what some of these other initiations might have been.
Okay. These other ideals, these other initiations in this. I think initiation is a perfect word. One thing would be the assumption of a different name. Mm-hmm. In magical orders, it's common for someone who is initiate to take upon a new name, right? A name that is used within the order. And that also becomes a new identity. For other rituals that one would take to show allegiance to a dark force, of course, there are things that are, you know, there are agreements, actual written down agreements. For instance, and this goes back, we mentioned Faustus. It's based on a real person, a guy named Dr. Johann George Faust. And in the tale Dr. Faust, which is, of course, inspired by the actual Faust, Dr. Faustus sells his soul via a document for 7 years of earthly pleasures, I believe, at the end of which his soul is forfeit. And during the witch hunts in Europe, there were quite a few people who were accused of signing pacts with the devil, sometimes null even with papers provided, and like the signature of the devil, which, not to, you know, far be it from me to cast a shadow on their methodology in the Inquisition, but that sounds a little convenient. But when we talk about rituals and initiations, brings us to something that is probably a story for a different time. Murders.
Sure.
Suicides.
Absolutely.
There are several very strange cases in the world of metal, but maybe metal deserves its own episode.
Yeah, I think it really does. There's a whole lot going on there, but we mentioned the band, maybe we didn't, but Mayhem was a very popular Norwegian black metal band that ultimately its members ended up sort of being on different ideological sides, more or less, and two of them got into a serious altercation that involved two of the members, Euronymous and a guy by the name of Varg Virknes.
Ah, yes.
Varg Virknes.
Who also has a YouTube channel
also
if you want
to
check it out.
If you want to, if you're interested, he went to prison for a long time, but I believe he is out now. Murdered this guy, Euronymous, who had kind of taken him under his wing in what some would argue was simply, you know, an altercation between two folks that maybe didn't see eye to eye on some things. But this is an altercation that ultimately ended in Euronymous receiving 23 stab wounds, 2 to the head, 5 to the neck, and 16 to the back. So, I mean, as far as ritualistic murders go, you know, if it was just a beef between two dudes, probably could have just stopped with the one. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Right.
Once he was down.
Making a statement.
Certainly. But this also goes back to my, my previous point about this having kind of like a gang mentality or like a cult mentality,
sure.
Which brings us to, in a lot of ways, the next point on our list.
Ah, yes. Ain't that fresh? Everyone wants to get down like that. Our next topic here is hip hop and
the Illuminati.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, if you are listening to this show, then the odds are that you may well be one of the people over the years who have requested that we talk about the Illuminati and hip-hop, that we explore it. So what's the gist of this, Noel?
So this idea that successful hip-hop stars are ultimately tools of the Illuminati, which is a shadowy group controlling the world through various financial, political, military, and cultural means – allegedly.
Right. We have a three-part YouTube series on it. We've talked at length about Adam Weishaupt and the founders, the various contradictory stories about what may or may not be the Illuminati, the different groups who consider themselves the Illuminati instead of other groups.
Of course. And so, you know, back to alleged things.
Right.
The alleged evidence of this connection is, well, you know, you don't have to look far. You can just get on YouTube, for example, and find just tons of these examples that show various musicians using symbols, like the all-seeing eye,
which,
for example.
Covering, you'll see clips of one person covering one eye, and then whomever uploaded the video will say, proof, Illuminati.
Right. Which proof is probably a little bit of a strong term
here.
It's
a strong term.
It's interesting. There's definitely a collection of this stuff. Some more ideas. For a lot of folks, this belief proves that the shadowy connections, rather than luck or talent, decide the success of an entertainer.
Yeah, but there's a fair counterpoint here, Noel. If this stuff is supposed to be so secret, then why would somebody show these symbols, these arcane, you know, secret handshakes or gestures on globally broadcasted videos and appearances.
I mean, it goes back to a lot of the stuff we were talking about earlier with the history of rock and using some of these symbols and backwards masking and, you know, the belief versus the showmanship of it. You know, I think there's a lot to be said of planting intriguing, arcane images and symbols into your work. It's just, it's neat. It's fun. It's fascinating. You know, people are intrigued by all kinds of things without necessarily having to be fully on board with every ideological, you know, idea.
Right. With the philosophy behind something.
Exactly.
It's absolutely true. Jay-Z in some interviews, it makes me chuckle because I'm a fan of Jay-Z. He's regularly said he's not part of the Illuminati and he feels like he has to say. He references it in verses and stuff. And I don't know, maybe we have some listeners who believe that there legitimately is something to this.
Sure.
I don't deny that there is a power behind the curtain, behind the throne, behind the scenes of the music industry, mm-hmm. in probably by genre, in country, in kind of, it's probably like some unseen mob boss type figure in mariachi music, you know? So hip hop's no different. So my question then is it more likely that these entertainers are, to Noel's point, seeking to capitalize on beliefs to stay edgy and in the public eye? Or is there something there? Is there some nefarious group of ultimately devil worshipers behind the scenes? Mm-hmm. Because in the 80s and the 90s, America thought so.
Well, I mean, you know, they say the love of money, you know, is the root of all evil. And to me, in a lot of these entertainment scenarios, money is the devil you don't see, you know, that like is driving all of these things. And, I mean, it's where the tastemakers come from. The folks that hold all the chips are the ones that, choose who, you know, gets the hits ultimately. And I mean, sure. There's certainly something to be said of public opinion and people going viral and things like that. But at the end of the day, largely it's a numbers game, you know, it's like, right. Who's getting the resources, who's getting all of the PR, and who's like actually, you know, commanding that kind of power.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to take a look at this thing, this satanic panic, mm-hmm. that swept the U.S. Some of you may be a little too young, but some of you may be old enough to remember this. The satanic panic is something that came about. It's considered a moral panic, comparable to witch hunts, for instance, in Europe, or the Red Scare with McCarthyism. And the idea was that there was a vast overarching conspiracy on the part of everyone from rock musicians to heavy metal musicians to blues musicians to racy singers. Mm-hmm. Poison the minds and souls of children, taking them into the abyssal plane of hell before their time.
They are kind of the low hanging fruit. Honestly, they are. You know, they're very, mm-hmm. very suggestible. No, I'm kidding.
It started in right. It's people who have mental issues brought on by their advanced age. So it's pretty much preschools and nursing homes. Is where you really try to sell that heavy metal, right?
Totally.
But anyhow, this starts in the 1970s, and it's this idea that there's this vast underground network of Satanists controlling everything. It rose and peaked in the 80s and 90s, but it's pretty much gone today. The first part of it that really launched this was a book called The Satan Seller by a guy named Mike Warnke in 1972. He was referenced as an authority on Satanism in 1972 published it, and he was referenced as an authority until 1992 when he was exposed as a fraud. So he, and then other people came in. A guy named John Todd said that he started speaking in churches saying that witches, druids, and the Illuminati were controlling world politics, media, and even, gasp, most churches. This led to worries about backward masking, like Noel mentioned earlier, worries that Dungeons and Dragons was a portal to this parallel occult world, the idea that there was satanic ritual abuse occurring in the studios of musicians. And we will see that there, you know, there is proof that there were abusive situations and ritualized. There is not proof that we could find that in the case of musicians. Notice I say in the case of musicians, not Hollywood overall.
Sure.
In the case of musicians, we don't find evidence of a vast network of abusive behavior. In the case of musicians, we don't. Mm-hmm. So the thing that happens with this is that you start to see politicians pick this up because it's essentially free votes, right? It's red meat. And it goes in 1985, Tipper Gore and some other people, some other associated.
This was the whole parental advisory thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. The Parents Music Resource Center. They wanted to They wanted to force the government to label records that were threatening to the hearts, minds, morals, or souls of American youth. So they had a succession of offensive materials, stuff like, "We're not going to take it" by Twisted Sister.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Sort of a bad attitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very strange. And then Geraldo Rivera did a documentary or a Rivera piece, I guess, called Devil Worship, Exposing Satan's Underground. And then, of course, Judas Priest went to trial for making a backwards message, which, let's see. There was a line in the song Better By You, Better Than Me, when played backwards, reportedly commanded the listener to do it, which is such a Rorschach ink blot, you know, an audio version of it.
Not only that, if you've ever messed around with flipping things backwards, I mean, that, you know, the way words sound in reverse are always a little bit off. And I could picture that was not even intentional almost, you know.
I'm sure, because what, you know, here's the thing. Long story short, what did they find in these investigations? Ultimately, they didn't find a damn thing. We can talk a little bit about mental health versus music. For instance, there's the question, when someone perpetrates an act of violence, right? And people attempt to blame it on a video game that person played or a song that they heard, right? Or, you know, just a book they read, then
it's always seemed very short-sighted to me.
Right. Even if that was the trigger, the likelihood is that it was no more than a proverbial straw.
Sure.
On a camel's back, you know.
That could have been replaced by any number of things.
It could have been any number
Somebody
of things.
Somebody looking at them funny at the grocery store. I mean, you know, honestly.
I just think it's more than opportunistic. It's more than convenient to blame a single thing mm-hmm. on something like that. I think it's offensive. It's offensive to the people who survived those kind of tragedies. It's offensive to the families of the victims. And not to mention the poor schmucks who just put out an album, you know?
Absolutely.
So we do know that there are, you know, this has been a long episode, but we do know that there are some true and proven corruption and cover-ups in music. There's the concept of payola, which you can probably speak to pretty well.
I'm not actually intimately familiar with it. I mean, I know it has to do with it's like the idea of the equivalent of like a lobbyist, you know, giving gifts or taking a lawmaker out for fancy dinners in exchange, or not necessarily exchange, but in the hopes that they will support their piece of legislation that benefits the lobbying group, the group they represent.
Yeah.
It's an example of something like that, where executives, I believe, pay DJs and radio station managers to play their songs.
Right.
And it's illegal.
Right. It's illegal. And the FCC specifically bans it. However, it's pretty common, right? The part where it becomes legal is when the radio station plays a specific song but doesn't disclose that they're playing it for money. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to be transparent about it. So that's something that really occurs, and it is kind of a cover-up. Then, you know, the exploitation of, gosh, especially the exploitation of up-and-coming talent in the music industry is something for itself. I want to close out, though, when we're talking about behind-the-scenes things in music and the occult.
I love this one.
Okay. There is an article in The Atlantic, which you can read online for free, called Hit Charade. Or charade,
yep.
For our fancy listeners. And here's the thing, guys. The vast majority of pop songs that are in the top of the charts right now are written by about 6 people.
And guess where they're from?
They're from Scandinavia. They're
Boom.
Norwegian.
Boom.
They're from Stockholm. There is one lady who was from Oklahoma, but she, now she works with these other guys. And they have names like Esther Dean, Mikkel Erickson, Tor Hermansen, Stargate, Dr. Luke. These folks have written songs like Bad Blood, Hey Mama, Worth It, Can't Feel My Face, The Night Is Still Young, and so on.
The main guy, though, you know, the main guy is this guy, Max Martin.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just him because, and I'm sorry if I'm stealing this from you, but this, the way, there's a great episode of On Point with Tom Ashbrook on NPR from a few days ago where they talk about the process of this whole thing. And I was not aware of this. They basically do this stuff by committee where like they have like the guy that does the hooks. They have the guy that does, you know, the beat. They have the, I mean, but more so than just like a collaborative thing. It's literally like a, they pass it down the line. And the idea is to stuff it with so many hooks that capitalize on that, I think, 15 seconds that someone listens to the
that
radio
before they every 15 seconds.
Before they change the station. Anyway, probably not necessarily a conspiracy. They're pretty open about it, but it's certainly something that the record industry kind of tried to keep under wraps.
I think for a long time it was literally stuff they don't want you to know.
And no, not necessarily any occult issues going on there, but it's pretty fascinating stuff for sure.
Wait. I hear that sound cue. Do you hear that?
I do.
You know what that means.
I know what it means. It means that it's time for me to apologize to Pope Francis. For real, you guys. We recorded last week's episode a few days before the story dropped. The Vatican finally issued a statement regarding Pope Francis's supposedly secret one-on-one meeting with Kim Davis, the Kentucky clerk who was denying marriage licenses to gay couples. And, you know, there was a lot being made of the fact that the Pope had this secret meeting, and I expressed my personal disappointment because I just was so fascinated by this Pope and his, more progressive, ways of doing things and very even-handed way of speaking about issues that popes don't typically handle. And as it turns out, this was entirely spun by Kim Davis's people. What was really going on was the Pope was meeting with a group of people for a very quick little handshake and a kind of a meet and greet kind of situation at this this Vatican embassy, essentially in D.C. And the only people that he actually was aware were going to be there, and I don't remember their name, but it was a student of his from, I believe he taught at a Catholic institution in Argentina. Isn't that where he's from?
Mm-hmm.
And this was a same-sex couple that he knew were going to be there. And he specifically expressed to his old friend or his student that he was excited to see him and wanted to give him a hug. And that was literally the only person that the Pope was there that he was aware was going to be there. So Kim Davis was one of about 15 or 20 or more folks that were just kind of there waiting for the Pope to pass through and hopefully have a little handshake and a, you know, a personal blessing. So I apologize, Your Holiness.
You're a man of principle, and sounds like you're a little bit bothered.
I'm bothered that I was so quick to jump on the bandwagon. I felt really bad about it. After the fact, I even considered adding an addendum to the episode, but I figured this would be the better way to do it, you know, come clean.
Well, as you know, the Pope, being a big fan of the show, was pretty upset.
Was he?
Yeah, and remember I mentioned the Snapchats that we send.
He did,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and he sent some pretty sad emoticons.
Really?
So you know, that's how it is. Sometimes you just get caught up in the heat of the moment.
Yeah, the furor of the internet.
Right, the pitchforks come out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting because that's similar to what happened in the Satanic Panic. You guys, we've got to go, but there's so much other stuff I wanted to get to here. There's so many other specific stories. I'm going to ask for your help specifically. Let me know what links you see between the world of music and the world of the occult. Tell me if you think it's absolute bunk. It's just baloney made up, but also tell me if you think there is clear, consistent proof of, you know, some sort of hip hop and Illuminati thing. I'd love to see, just because at this point, what I can say probably happens is that there are groups running different things behind the scenes. Right. We've said this in our Illuminati episode. There are a lot of people that want to control the world. but there's no one at this point who controls the whole thing, not even international bankers. And they would be one of the draft picks, right?
Absolutely.
So hopefully, tune in next week. We'll, have an update from Matt Frederick, who is with us in spirit. Stay tuned this weekend. If you're hearing this with the day it goes live, we're going to do our live show with, our friend Steve, the intern. And if you'd like to check out some of the stories that don't make it to the air, find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we are Conspiracy Stuff. If you have an idea for a show, a reaction, just want to say hello, but don't like the social media rigmarole, we of all people get it. You can email us directly. Our address is
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com. For more on this topic and other unexplained phenomena, visit youtube.com/conspiracystuff. You can also get in touch on Twitter at the handle @conspiracystuff.